A warning before we begin, this episode of The Big Story contains disturbing content. It's not like the music community at large didn't know about R. Kelly. Nobody can make that claim. Everyone had heard the rumors, or followed the child pornography trial, or shuddered at the latest allegation in recent years of his treatment of young women, some of them allegedly minors, who were staying in his home. And then, this past weekend, Lifetime aired a 6-part documentary called Surviving R. Kelly.
I would definitely characterize myself as a survivor.
I do see myself as a victim of R. Kelly.
I was a victim.
I don't consider myself a victim.
I am a survivor.
So nobody gets to pretend to be surprised, but that still didn't prepare us for hearing the testimony firsthand from survivors. And after sifting through the horrific stories about one of music's biggest hitmakers, the only questions left are more expressions of disbelief than anything else. Who could have known about this stuff and still worked with him? This wasn't a secret. Why have so many of the most famous people in music, nearly all of whom have recorded with R. Kelly over the past 2 decades, not spoken out about him? What is different here from so many other revelations in recent years that lead to immediate condemnations? And will anything happen to R. Kelly this time? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Dalton Higgins is a publicist, a journalist, author of several books on urban music, including a recent biography of Drake. Dalton, after watching this documentary, which covers a couple of decades in which you were swimming in these waters, what were you thinking?
I thought Dream Hampton did a fantastic job. And Dream Hampton, by the way, she's a very well-respected journalist in the urban music landscape.
Yeah.
In my ecosystem, super well-respected. So she worked on a book with Jay-Z and kind of comes out of the milieu that I come out of, having, you know, I used to write for the Source magazine in New York, Vibe magazine in New York. And so she's part of the same kind of, that collective of journalists that very much into facts, you know, like she's almost like a hard news journalist.
Yep.
So I felt good. I wanted to dig into some of the facts. What I learned about R. Kelly, which is something that I don't think a lot of R. Kelly enthusiasts knew, is that he was himself a victim of child molestation between the ages of 7 and 13. That kind of taught, I think, a lot of the viewers something in that, you know, that saying where they say hurt people hurt people?
Yeah.
Well, this guy, clearly, there's a lot of trauma, you know, that had not been dealt with, you know, with counseling. And also mental health, like it just wasn't dealt with, you know? And that's not at all to excuse anything he did, but the guy he's damaged, you know?
It seems like this conversation has like kind of started and picked up a little steam and then gone away like, I don't know, 5 or 6 times since the late 90s. What's different right now?
Yeah, I think there's certainly, heightened awareness around issues tied to, sexual assault, pedophilia, child molestation. And social media. Yeah. I would say social media is the big difference. So you'll recall there have been campaigns launched, anti-R. Kelly campaigns that have gone viral, on Twitter, mute R. Kelly,
yep.
Surviving R. Kelly now. And I find that, back in the days, if you look at the way it was presented, R. Kelly, this idea of this guy, he's in his 20s, comfortably, mid to late 20s, dating, Aaliyah. We can start there.
Yeah.
She's 15. Well, 14. He's working with her. She's 14.
This is, we should say, back in the late 90s, the first time the public kind of became conscious of R. Kelly anywhere beyond music.
Yes, precisely. And if you kind of look at the way it was reported on back then, it was just sort of sloughed off,
Yeah.
It was people kind of stuck their head in the sands or in the clouds. And it's just like, okay, it's an aberration, an anomaly. He's a great musician, 12 plays and a fantastic album. Keep it moving,
Yeah.
And, we fast forward to today. And if you heard, just for example, that a, 27-year-old, R&B artist or rapper or pop star were dating a 15-year-old or getting married to a 15-year-old, like, how would you respond now?
Yeah, right now it's, I think there would be no, especially considering the social media age we live in, there would be no room, and there shouldn't be, for anything but condemnation.
Precisely. And I think a lot of, back to this whole heightened awareness, we're hearing a lot of cases tied to, gross adult male pop culture figures.
Yeah.
I can reference a bunch, Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby in Canada, John Gomeshi. And I think, you know, R. Kelly, when, you know, some charges were, you know, laid, you know, back in the early 2000s.
He had a wave to the media and fans waiting for him. His burden lifted after being acquitted on all 14 counts of child pornography. It was a resounding victory for the superstar singer after a six-year legal odyssey.
When he was acquitted, you know, we all here, you know, certainly me as a pop culture critic, we felt that same sort of sick feeling when we found out that somebody like John Gomeshi, for example, got acquitted on all charges, you know, sexual assault, choking. So I think, yeah, social media and more people are just a lot more aware of these monsters that are these predators in Hollywood, in the music industry. You know, there are just so many anecdotes we can point to now.
The thing that strikes me as different about the R. Kelly story in particular is the ones you mentioned, sort of John Gomeshi is a good example, or Harvey Weinstein. These are people who the stories came out and they were almost immediately blacklisted out of their industry, right? Like John Gomeshi was gone from the CBC. He hasn't had work since. Harvey Weinstein's facing criminal charges. Nobody's working with him in Hollywood right now. But, you know, as you say, the first criminal charges against R. Kelly occurred in the early 2000s, and he's had hundreds of songs with artists from around the spectrum and award nominations and Grammy nominations. What is different about him?
I would say it's something having to do with the music culture in general. What they did a good job of in Surviving R. Kelly, this six-part series, is sort of outlining how in music culture there are all these stories. They're all like, it's almost like he was working out of the tradition of, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, marrying, you know, his 13-year-old cousin, and Elvis Presley fornicating with Priscilla Presley when she was quite young, and there's just this whole tradition.
Well, she was just 17, and you know, Presley, 16.
So in the music culture, you have a lot of enablers, you have a lot of handlers, and all of these layers, you know, like this idea of R. Kelly's tour manager and personal assistant sort of, you know, going out to malls and high schools and recruiting girls, you know, to come backstage to the green room to come to concerts. This has been going on in the music industry since Jesus, you know?
Right.
So R. Kelly is just, a symptom of a much larger problem, I'd say, in the music industry. Being someone who kind of dabbles, you know, in my publicity, my company, we deal with a lot of musicians.
Yeah.
And there is a culture of kind of like, hey, let's go out in the audience and get, youngish looking girls in the green. It's disgusting.
What kinds of dark little secrets were being passed around? Because there's one instance, the thing that Surviving R. Kelly kind of brings into the light is not just the very well publicized trial that he had regarding that sex tape, but then everything that came afterwards, the allegations of keeping young women sort of trapped at his house. I won't get into all the other horrible things that they, the survivors themselves, say in their own words. But there's a difference between that stuff coming to light in a court of law and then the next 10 plus years of like these whispers. And how loud were those whispers in the community? And what did people inside the music business kind of know before this documentary came out?
The interesting thing with R. Kelly is, you know, hindsight is 20/20. As we look back and forward, I mean, his art imitated his life. And yeah. I can't believe that. You know, he produces Aaliyah. Let's go back there. He produces Aaliyah's debut album, Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. And the single is essentially spelling out this idea of having this sort of secretive romance with a, you know, an underage to somebody, you know, and it being okay. Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. And his whole career, if you look at his whole track record, his discography, there's just a bunch of songs that are referencing, you know, what he's doing in real life. So it's just amazing to me that, you know, journalists, I think they are complicit in all this, to blame, because they could have done a better job of taking him to task as far as in the traditional sort of media landscape, you know, television, radio, print, is that they didn't kind of just really blow it open, you know, like, because he's essentially singing about all of these sexual improprieties and that he's doing. It's all in his art, you know.
What kind of reaction have you seen the people you talk to in the music industry? First of all, back in the day when these allegations kind of first emerged into the public consciousness versus now?
I would say back then it was treated more comedic than tragic.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, Dave Chappelle, I'm a big fan of Dave Chappelle, his stand-up routine and his show, and I've seen him. And it's interesting, you know, he did a whole skit, you know, like There was a tape circulating, and I remember this like it was yesterday, because it was one of the hottest tapes. You know, when you're getting like, you know, bootleg, you know, DVDs or videos, kind of like the, you know, the Kim Kardashian sex tape or with Ray J. So people are just talking about this tape. R. Kelly, again, totally disgusting, you know, urinating on a minor during, you know, while fornicating with a minor. And back then, you know, it was like a laughing, it was a joke, you know? So
yeah. Well, Chappelle made the skit about it.
Yeah, he made a skit about it. But the thing is, people found it funny.
If a man cannot pee on his fans, I don't want to be in show business anymore because, well, that's why I got in the game, baby. I got dreams too.
It wasn't treated like a tragedy of epic proportions like it should have. It was a joke, the fact that he's, you know, peeing on minors.
If that was now, I feel like that's when the tide still would have begun to turn against him. Because again, you look at Gomeshi, also acquitted, but in terms of popular culture, done.
So here's the thing, you know, if we juxtapose it with how Harvey Weinstein, how that was treated. I mean, a lot of powerful, influential figures in Hollywood and outside of Hollywood, they spoke out.
Yeah.
And clearly not nearly enough musicians, R&B artists, rappers, pop stars, people who he's collaborated with, you know, virtual who's who of A-list musicians have not spoken out publicly, right?
Yeah, why is that?
For one, I would say that them not speaking out means they are a bit complicit in it continuing to happen. You know, the question I would pose to anybody, you know, Jay-Z, it could be, you know, I don't know, Celine Dion, anybody he's collaborated with is, if that were your daughter that were being urinated on or being dated underage, you know, 27-year-old dating 14, 15-year-old, what would you say? What would you do?
Yeah.
That's the question I'd pose to them. I think we need to hold them to account. You know, when I say that, I really mean it. I think they are complicit. If I see some act of, you know, it can be anything, racism, sexism, homophobia, and I'm just sitting there while it occurs and have said nothing about it, nothing to challenge it, nothing to debate it, dispute it, to, you know, complain again. Like, I'm complicit, you know, I'm complicit. So that's, you know, yeah, it's very disappointing. You know, it's hugely disappointing that someone like a Jay-Z. Well, I am glad, actually, that John Legend, you know, that he says, hey, the guy's, you know, it's a child molester, a serial child molester. I have zero issue partaking in this document, in this series, Surviving R. Kelly, and speaking out against it, you know, moving forward, right? I'm very proud of somebody like John Legend, that he actually had the cojones, the courage to just do what's right, the right thing.
Do you think misogyny in the urban music industry, or even just in the pop music machine, plays a role in why more people weren't willing to speak up?
You know, rappers and R&B singers didn't invent sexism, nor did they invent misogyny. They just, this is America, good old America, you know? If you look at the president that's in office, President Trump, he's one of those sexist, misogynist, you know, human beings alive, you know, in my personal opinion. And he's not a rapper, you know, he's not an R&B singer. And so, in the rap music scene, like the pop music scene, like any music scene, is it misogyny exists? 100%. It's super sexist, super misogynist. What I would say is that rappers, they found some sort of formula that I don't agree with of how to sort of translate that into profit, you know? So they're kind of saying, hey, you know, if sex, drugs, and rock and roll, if that formula, which predates them, existed way before rap was invented some 40 plus years ago, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's what sells. That's what fills seats in stadiums. And we're going to sort of take that and then amplify it.
One of the things that comes to light in that documentary that really, I shouldn't say surprised me, but really struck home is how many people say that these accounts were discarded and these women were not believed because they were young black women, and the community in which he was operating is inherently misogynistic, especially towards young black women.
I would say because it was largely black women as victims, I would say that as far as the mainstream, completely ignored, discarded, not taken seriously. Absolutely. I do agree with that assessment. The reason I say that is, you know, again, if we look at just American culture in general and then American, you know, popular culture in particular, it's not a level playing field at all. You know, when we talk about issues around race, you know, race doesn't exist on a separate island. You know, you see it pop up in, you know, in how, you know, the criminal justice system, how it treats both, you know, black victims and perpetrators of crime. Like, so there's no level playing field. So for people to somehow naively think that race doesn't play a part in how, you know, the victims, the alleged victims were treated, how it was treated in the broader popular culture, meaning sort of like non-black media, virtually ignored, not taken that seriously. There's a lot of, definitely a lot of truth to that. And like what I'm suggesting is if the victims were, let's say, you know, I live in Toronto, let's say the victims were, you know, Caucasian, came from the upper crust, you know, Forest Hill bridal path. And it was found that a bunch of, you know, sort of teens, minors were being molested by some, you know, some musician. I what I'm willing to suggest is I think it would be taken a lot more serious than if it were happening in the black community.
Does this finally end, R. Kelly? And I ask this sort of not totally sarcastically, but this is not the first time that headlines have hit multiple outlets and everybody has thought, finally, this is going to be the end of him.
I'm feeling a bit jaded and cynical, you know, around any ideas around muting R. Kelly, surviving R. Kelly, in that, we just found out that, you know, on Spotify, on the DSPs, you know, iTunes, people are continuing to stream his music, you know, at record, like, there's a big bump. What is it, 16%?
Yeah, 16% on Spotify over the weekend since the documentary aired. So, I mean, the kind interpretation of that is that people are curious. The unkind interpretation is that this documentary has driven more fans to him.
Right, precisely. And there's a way, you know, I can look at it. I can sort of look at these numbers. You know, on the one hand, non-R. Kelly enthusiasts are probably wanting to check out, like, what's the big deal? You know, this thing has gone viral. It's trending on Twitter, on social media. What is this all about? Let me check out some of his back catalog, some of the music that we're talking about that references
some of the
sexual
specific songs. Yeah,
precisely. But then on the other hand, I'm thinking to myself, when you truly ban and cancel and outlaw somebody who's just doing the wrong thing, you really mean it. You really need to do that. You can't. I mean, I blame concert promoters. I mean, R. Kelly has been touring over the last 10, 15 years, still touring, still selling out arenas, still has a tour manager, still has a booking agent, still has a management company that is representing his interests. Fans are continuing to buy tickets to R. Kelly concerts.
Yeah.
We are all a part of the problem, is what I'd say.
Thanks, Dalton.
Hey, thank you.
Dalton Higgins, publicist, journalist, and author. That was The Big Story. For more from us, hit us up at thebigstorypodcast.ca and find us on social media. We have a new handle on Twitter, at TheBigStoryFPN, which stands for Frequency Podcast Network, which means we have some other social media stuff coming for you very soon. You can also find us, as you well know, everywhere you get podcasts, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, Pocket Casts, whatever you like. And when you're there, do not forget to leave a review and a rating. We very much appreciate it. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.